You are listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And ciao, come stai? Daniele Fribarencini.
I'm actually in Monte Carlo this week, Rich, so you have to speak to me in French.
Oh, really? Are you?
Well, it's the last week I was in a meeting room called Acapulco. This week it's Monte Carlo.
Oh, yeah, you're in your
ship. There's another one. Another one I'm eligible to use is called Kingston. So I'm keeping that up my sleeve. What is it that what was our joke last year about someone in the Wailers? God, I can't remember.
Bob Marley.
Yeah, there was a rider. Yeah. There was a rider's name you couldn't pronounce, so you were pronouncing
Superman
and the Wailers. Maybe I'll be coming to you live next week from Kingston.
Well, it could be Kingston, UK, of course. Maybe correct. Not necessarily Kingston, Jamaica. You'll be avoiding it if it's Kingston, UK, eh? Ça va, then, Daniel? Let's try that again. Ça va?
Très bien, merci.
Are you in your shared working space, then, in Berlin?
Correct.
Excellent. And how are you, Lionel?
I'm very good, thanks. I've been had quite a busy week or so since returning from our winter break.
Have we got all the rust off from last week, do you think? Rusty old start, wasn't it last week?
Yeah, it was like a chain that wouldn't quite fit on the sprocket neatly, wasn't it? It was just a sort of a rattle throughout the whole episode slow-moving cogs in our brains.
And it's clear that it's clear that this week's not going to be any better. But an early corrections corner for 2020 for me. A few of you got in touch to say that Geraint Thomas on a rival podcast said that he would not be riding the Giro, that he'd be riding the Tour de France.
Didn't I get in touch live during the podcast and said, Richard, no, you're talking rubbish?
I'm not sure that you did, although, I mean, there's evidence out there for that. We could go back and listen, but wouldn't encourage anybody to do that.
Hang on, guys, you're both proving my point, which is that the machinations and the speculation about who Ineos's leaders are going to be at the Grand Tours is just a giant red herring.
It's not, because I actually know now, because I got in touch with a senior source at Team Ineos, whose name is Dave Brailsford, and I put it to him that Geraint Thomas would be riding the Giro with Richard Carapaz, and I said, what are the chances of that? 0%, 25%, 50%, or 100%? And the answer came back, a very definitive 0%, which doesn't leave a lot of wriggle room.
Buffalo journalism. He didn't ask Dave Brailsford. He put it to Dave Brailsford that Geraint Thomas would be riding the Giro.
I suggested that he should.
This is like some kind of terrible ITV game show from the 80s, guess the percent. But the irony, the point is, hang on, if you'd said last April what percentage chances Egan Bernal are going to be the leader at the Giro, it would have been 100%, and it ended up being 0%. That is my entire point. We don't know
what's going to happen.
They line up on the start line.
Lionel, what I would say is that actually I don't want to plug a rival podcast, but I did detect in this rival podcast that I won't mention that Luke Rowe, who co-presents this rival podcast, he seemed to be hinting that Geraint Thomas might be right, or that there was a desire in the team for him to ride the Giro. That's what I was kind of picking up on. However, that's not
what
the team's
plan. What was the hint? Was it this cornetto? Was it just one cornetto music playing in the background? I'm intrigued by the. What was this hint?
It was a subtext. It was very subtext. If you played it backwards, like an old Madonna record, you got this. You will ride the Giro, but no, he's riding the Tour. So is Egan Bernal and Chris Froome, if he makes progress. He's working extremely hard to get back to fitness. But what I take from this, which is interesting, is that it doesn't appear to be guaranteed that Chris Froome will go to the Tour. It will depend on his recovery, which is he's on the back foot.
Well, 4 months of further speculation about Team Ineos and who's going to lead their teams at the Giro and the Tour.
I hold
my head at this.
Okay, it's not currently planned for him to ride the Giro anyway, but we'll see what happens. What can you definitively tell us has happened, Lionel?
Well, I can stick to the mostly factual news roundup if you prefer. The Australian Road Race Championships have taken place in Victoria. Amanda Spratt won her third title. She seems to be in the habit of winning in an Olympic year because her previous titles were in 2012 and 2016. The men's race was won by Cameron Meyer ahead of his Mitchelton Scott teammate Lucas Hamilton.
Just a first interruption, chaps. I wasn't aware until the weekend that the Australian Nationals was taking place on the same course for 20-something years.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, how do you feel about that? I mean, obviously, you know, the reasons why that happens are mainly sort of logistical and practical, and it becomes, after a while, it becomes very difficult to move it, and it becomes even quite difficult to move the finish line, to have the finish line at a different point on the circuit. But, you know, I've seen quite a lot of people very aggrieved at this fact, but I don't think it's so terrible as long as there's a hill on the course of some description. And there's been a reasonable variety of winners there. There have been a few sort of sprinter-type riders, and of course, Cam Meyer won this year. I don't know whether he got that far, Napalm.
He did, yeah. And an early plug, we've got an interview with Sarah Gigante, who won the women's race last year and won the time trial this year in the Australian Nationals in the Cycling Podcast Feminar, which comes out later this week.
I mean, every year an Australian wins it, Daniel. Is that what you're objecting to? Anyway, on a more serious note, one of the big stories from Australia has been the bushfires, which have affected large parts of the countryside and the towns. And I've been very interested to know whether that would have any impact on the Tour Down Under in Adelaide, which kicks off next week, or the Herald Sun Tour in Melbourne shortly afterwards. Somebody drew my attention to an air quality map, which seems to indicate that the air quality around Adelaide is pretty good at the moment. But in Melbourne, where the Australian Open Tennis Championships are due to take place imminently, in fact, they're in the qualifying stages at the moment, players have been struggling with the smoke in the air. I've been interested in just the impact of the environment on professional cycling and also professional cycling's impact on the environment, really since one of our friends of the podcast posed a question to us during the Tour de France last year. And I'm actually working on an episode about the climate crisis and professional cycling. I've been talking to some climate scientists this week. That episode will come out in due course. I've found the more that I've investigated the issue, the less clear I am on things. It's a pretty complex and very broad issue. But it was very interesting while I've been speaking to people who have real deep knowledge and expertise on the subject that De Koninck Quickstep released a press release this week saying that they're aiming to become the first carbon neutral cycling team. They've got a hashtag, of course, It Starts With Us. They're going to try to become greener. Sustainability is going to be at the heart of what they do. In the press release, they've worked out that the carbon footprint of the team is 1,288 tonnes of CO2, which is the equivalent of driving a car 179 times around the world, or 539 return flights between Brussels and New York. And the amount of forestation required to capture this amount of CO2 is the equivalent of around 3,099 football pitches. They've basically done this, they found this out, calculated this rather, in association with CO2 Logic, who are now on my list of people to speak to for this climate change issue.
Napalm, it would be some feat, wouldn't it, to become completely carbon neutral? I mean, you gave some of the figures there, but I think I quoted in the podcast a couple of years ago, I spoke to one team manager about this issue. And he said that they were spending over €500,000 a year on fuel for the team.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's vast, isn't it? There are a couple of initiatives that De Koninck Quickstep are are going to be undertaking in order to kind of offset their carbon footprint. And we'll go into this issue in more detail in a future episode rather than trying to paraphrase now. But the perspective from the climate scientists that I've spoken to so far, all of whom have an interest in professional cycling, so they're talking with a bit of a knowledge of the sport, whether as fans of the sport. So listen out for that in hopefully not too long, maybe a 2 or 3 weeks time. Anyway, on with the news. Another Belgian team, Lotto Soudal, have announced that they are banning alcohol at all races and training camps. The exceptions will be riders' birthdays, victories and special occasions, which makes me wonder whether something like stage 3 of the 4 days of Dunkirk will now be deemed a special occasion. What will be the criteria for a special occasion?
A Thomas de Gent breakaway.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that.
Not your birthday again, is it, Thomas?
Yeah, well, a Thomas de Gent breakaway is cause for celebration in the team, and every team meeting, Thomas de Gent's told to get in the breakaway, yeah.
We've heard this kind of thing before, and I actually have a vague memory of Lotto, Marc Sargent, the manager, having to address this issue maybe about 10 years or so ago. I know that HTC, they banned alcohol, or Bob Stapleton, when he took over that team, and one of the policies was that they would ban alcohol except when the team won. And I think it's fairly common, but I think traditionally, when we have heard about a bit of a sort of, not a drinking culture, but that the drinks flowing a bit more sort of freely than you would maybe expect among the staff, it's been in the Belgian teams. I think in this case, the way it's been reported, this is at least partly a response to what happened with Kevin De Veer, a staff member. He was a director sportif or performance manager last year at the Vuelta, wasn't it? He was sent home just before the Vuelta last year.
Yeah, John Lalong, who's the new boss of the team, isn't he? So stepping into Mark Sargent's shoes this year, he has said, you know, made a very valid point that, you know, people may be required to drive certainly staff members may be required to drive vehicles. But yeah, it will be maybe a cultural change for the staff than the riders, you know, who probably are used to, the mechanics are probably used to finishing their shift quite late at night and then having a beer at the end of their working day. But well, there we are. That's their new policy. This particular story is making me wince just thinking about having to read it out. Chris Hamilton of Team Sunweb will miss the Tour Down Under because he ruptured a testicle in a training crash a couple of weeks ago. He said on Instagram, "Yep, fellas, it's just as painful as you think it is." I think we'll leave that there. But that does, you know, the human body is quite vulnerable in bike crashes, but that's one of the more painful, or certainly one of the more eye-watering injuries that I've heard about.
Get well soon, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, Bernard Eisel, the Austrian rider, has retired at the age of 38. He joined MAPPE in 2001 and was part of the MAPPE development team in 2002, a contemporary of Fabian Cancellara, Filippo Pozzato and Mick Rogers. He then went on to ride for FDJ, then T-Mobile, which became Columbia, and HTC Columbia. Then he moved to Sky, and the final 4 years of his career have been with Dimension Data. He was really part of the Mark Cavendish axis, wasn't he, along with Mark Renshaw. They were kind of the band of brothers, and Eisel has got Mark Cavendish
the
over.
Axis of Eisel.
The axis of Eisel. Very good, Richard. And Eisel certainly shepherded Cavendish over many a mountain at the Tour de France. Eisel started the Tour 12 times and finished every one of them, and his biggest race win was Gent-Wevelgem in 2010. He was in a group of six that contested the finish and beat Sepp van Marke, Philippe Gilbert and George Hincapie in the sprint. He had a very bad crash at Tirreno Adriatico in March 2018 and suffered a pretty bad head injury, and his comeback from that, Daniel, you documented in an excellent episode for Friends of the Podcast last year, which is still available for people to listen to.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
I am Egan Bernal. I ride for Team Ineos, and my favorite product of Science in Sport is the Cafe Angel.
Well, that was Egan Bernal there, who will 100% be starting the Tour de France this year for Team Ineos, telling us his favourite Science and Sport gel. And we must say a big thank you to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast. Very, very grateful to them. And they can help you with your training and your fueling by offering 25% off all their sports nutrition products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. Enter that at the checkout at scienceandsport.com and stock up on all your gels, drinks, bars, and some interesting new products coming soon. In fact, we're going to do a taste test on some of them, Lionel, so listen out for that. Now, the bulk of this episode is going to be taken up with an interview with Ian Boswell, who's moving into a new phase of his career, mainly talking, though, about his concussion and related problems from last year. That's coming up really, really interesting. But you finished the news roundup there, Lionel, talking about Bernie Eisel, who's retiring. And it's the end of an era, isn't it? The last MAPI survivor. Daniel's the only MAPI survivor left in the peloton. And, well, I don't think, although he's 38, he wasn't looking to retire, was he? He was looking for another team.
I think he was, Rich, yeah. And he was a real sort of survivor. Bernie Eisel had become invaluable for a lot of teams that he was in over the years. But, you know, even the start of his career, you know, there were a lot of sort of sliding doors moments early in his career. And he sort of ended up on the right side of those. And when he turned pro for MAPEI, he'd gone to the World Championships in Plouay in 2000 as an amateur, desperate to turn pro. And, you know, his agent had asked MAPEI, and they said, no, our roster's full for the 2001 season. And he went home and was pretty disconsolate, and then got a call, I think, you know, a night or two later, and they said, well, it was good news and bad news. Good news is we're going to give you a two-year contract. Bad news is you need to be at the airport at sort of 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. And he phoned up his mate, Pippo Pozzato, and said, Pippo, guess what? You know, it's not just you that's on the team next year, MAPEI. I'm coming as well. And, you know, I'm going to swing by your house tomorrow on the way to the training camp. And then, you know, he started there in that sort of very much, well, fated young team, academy kind of team that they started at MAPEI. And then, you know, when MAPEI folded, he was in a bad spot again a couple of years later. And I remember him telling me that he was at the airport, I think, after Paris-Corrèze, the stage race, and just sort of waiting for his bag to come off the conveyor belt. And Jimmy Casper, who he said he'd never had anything to do with except in sort of fairly lively conversations, version of altercations in the peloton, sort of walked over and said, in French, a language that Bernie didn't understand at the time, what are you doing next year? And they sort of, through sign language, they managed to establish that he didn't have a contract for the following year. And Casper said, look, I want you on Française des Jeux. And at that stage, Eisel could have been a rival for Casper, because he started his career really as a sprinter and then became very much a classic specialist at La Française des Jeux. And then later in his career, after he moved to T-Mobile, became much more of a domestique, a lead-out man at first. And then later, as he lost a bit of speed, became very much that sort of road captain and the real sort of guard dog to Mark Cavendish. You know, endless stories about those two. I mean, I think my favourite one was the one where I think it was about 2008 or 2009, they were sort of riding to make the time limit, or trying to make the time limit somewhere in the Pyrenees, and they ended up having a fight mid-stage, an argument mid-stage, and they rode, I think, the whole way up either the Aspin or the Tourmalet on opposite sides of the road.
2010. It was 2010. It was a stage, you might remember, where that was won by the it was the breakaway had the controversial Lance Armstrong in it. It was his final hurrah.
Yeah.
And it had been very fast from the start in Luchon, and they'd been climbing immediately, and they had a long sort of run in, and they were really battling to stay in the time limit, and they fell out, didn't they? And
over calculations about the time limit, I think.
I interviewed Eisel about this once, and he said they made up by, he went back to the car and got Cavendish a can of Coke. He said it was like feeding apples to a horse. You know, that's how they used to sort of make up after these arguments. But you can imagine the pair of them riding up opposite sides of the road. I'd actually been trying to get him on the podcast towards the end of last year to hear about his plans, and And at one point, he seemed quite confident that he was going to have a team for this year, but that's obviously fallen through. But he's been a real sort of elder statesman, but as you say, also guard dog, Daniel. And he's been quite a vocal, a Cancellara type sort of figure in the peloton, in being the voice of the peloton a lot of the time. And he did say in his statement that he will, or is looking to stay in the sport. And I can certainly imagine that. He's been on various kind of, he's been rider representative on UCI committees and so on as well. I don't think he's going to disappear, is he?
No, we did some medium work a couple of years ago as well, when he had that layoff after the very bad crash he had at Tirreno. And yeah, I think a few people will be surprised that he didn't go with Cavendish to Bahrain Merida. You know, I think it was sort of half jokingly, or well, probably more than half jokingly, probably very much intended to be light-hearted comment. Mark Cavendish said to me last year that if they did another year together, then he would probably, one of them would end up probably murdering the other one. Their relationship was very much like that. I think they have a lot of affection for each other, but there were plenty of fallings out, which were usually, you know, remedied within the space of a few hours or at most a couple of days.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, the Tour de France, interrupting our episode to remind me to tell you that we are sponsored by the Watt Bike Atom again this week. And, well, we talked a little bit last week about how versatile the Watt Bike Atom can be. This week we're going to hear from a Watt biker called Andy Hayton, who rode Le Loop, which is basically the route of the Tour de France, cycled in the same time as the race itself, 21 days. And he prepared for Le Loop last year using the Watt Bike Atom. So let's hear from Andy.
I think it was sort of the physical challenge first. A few years back, I did ride London and maybe wanted to push myself a little bit further. And I'd always struggled with hills, so I decided to set myself a goal of riding up a mountain. And I thought about doing the Etape, but when I found Le Loop, I was immediately sold. It was only after sort of signing up that the enormity of the challenge then sunk in. The Atom was an amazing training partner, really. It allowed me to get really good quality training sessions in all year round at a time that suited me. It's also great to fit around family life, and of course, better still, you know, I can also do the workouts that I need. So sometimes that could be an endurance ride, which might be a few hours on Zwift. Other times it's a much shorter, say a VO2 max session, you know, do short intervals and things like that. So it's a very flexible piece of kit. And I would have found it very hard to fit in all the necessary training otherwise. It's sort of turning training almost from an art form into a science.
Well, as Andy says there, without the Watt Bike Atom, he doesn't feel he would have completed Le Loop, certainly not in as good shape as he was when he reached Paris. It's that time of year, January, lots of people doing indoor training. But as he said, the Watt Bike Atom came into its own in the summer months as well, as he approached the start date of Le Loop. So indoor training isn't just for the winter. You can train indoors all year round. And if you would like to try out the Watt Bike Atom, go to wattbike.com, that's wattbike.com, and a Watt Bike Atom is available this month for just £76 per month.
Well, we'll hear from Ian Boswell in a moment, but, well, a couple of exciting announcements. One of them concerns Ian Boswell, and you've got one as well, Lionel.
Well, yeah, the Cycling Podcast big off-season signing, we can now reveal that Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton podcast will be moving across to the Cycling Podcast feed in a couple of weeks' time. And before that, next week's episode will be an interview with Mitch himself, which I did when I went to Girona towards the end of last year to find out a bit more about Mitch Docker. He's been doing the Life in the Peloton podcast since the start of 2016. It's a really entertaining, engaging, very laid back, listen. You know, he's a conversationalist, really. They're not really interviews. And certainly they caught our ear in the last couple of years. And, well, we got chatting at the Vuelta last year, and the idea
is this a bit like US Postal buying up Roberto Heras?
What,
just buying up all the competition?
Buy up the competition. Well, I mean, it's a really good podcast. And so, well, what we're hoping is that, well, we'll take over the kind of the production of the podcast, and it will leave Mitch with more time to think about who he wants to go and speak to, what direction he wants to take his podcast in. So we won't be sort of meddling with the successful format of his podcast. We will just be enhancing here and there where we can. And so next week's cycling podcast will be my interview with Mitch. During the Tour Down Under, we will also put on our feed sort of edited versions of some of Mitch's favourite Life in the Peloton podcasts from his back catalogue. Included in that, I know we're going to play the Marcel Kittel one, we're going to play a Luke Durbridge one, Swain Tuft, Theo Gegenhardt I think is another one. So I think there'll be five or six of those running over the course of the Tour Down Under. And then we will be publishing Life in the Peloton with Mitch Docker from Wednesday, the 29th of January. And his first guest is Jimmy Whelan. And I've heard the podcast. It's a cracking listen. So really looking forward to seeing what Mitch is going to deliver for us over the course of the year. And welcome on board, Mitch.
Welcome. He's got some great plans, very exciting ideas about, you know, writers to and other people to interview and things to do in audio this year. So really looking forward to that collaboration. And another new signing for the podcast is the writer we're about to hear from, Ian Boswell. He is going to be contributing every month to Explore, which will relaunch in February. It was run as a series last winter, but it'll be a monthly episode from now on, presented by Lionel. But Ian Boswell will be telling us all about his transition to gravel racing and about that scene in the US. We had a chat with him about that earlier today. He's very excited about that, and we are too. But we wanted to hear in some length from Ian. I went out to Nice in December to visit him because he was packing up his apartment and preparing to move everything back to the US after, I think, how many years? 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 7 years. After seven...
Maths genius Richard Moore there, counting on his
fingers. After 7 years as a pro with Team Sky and Katusha Alpecin, he is retiring at quite a young age, and it's been forced upon him to a large extent by a very serious crash at Tirreno Adriatico last year, where he suffered his sixth concussion. And there were quite a lot of serious after effects and unknowns about that too. So he's made the decision to retire, but I wanted to talk to him about that experience, about what last year was like, and about his decision to retire. So we'll hear all about that now, and then take a little break and come back and hear a bit more about what he's going to do next and about his thoughts on concussion and how cycling tackles that problem. Ian, take me back to Tirreno Adriatico, start of the season, March. Take me back to the day that you crashed and what happened.
Yeah, it was stage four of Tirreno, and it was actually the first race of the year that I actually started to feel like I'm coming into form and I'm starting to get fit, which is always like a nice feeling to have. And we were on a descent, and I don't really know what happened or how it happened, but yeah, I wound up crashing, going over my handlebars and hitting the back of my head and going unconscious for a short period of time, and woke up in an ambulance, and that was the end of my racing for 2019.
You woke up and you went to hospital, I think, in Italy, didn't you? And then you were transferred back here, is that right? I think... Was Geraint Thomas, did he crash out that same day as well?
Yeah, funny enough, I was actually speaking to G earlier in that stage. And I was like, oh, dude, you should move up. Like, it's kind of crunch time. And he's like, no, it's way too dangerous. I'm not going to the front. Like, I'm not willing to take these risks. Like, my goal is the Tour, which is understandable. So I had crashed, and I went to the hospital in Italy. And thankfully, our team doctor was on the bus watching the race, and there was a shot of me unconscious on the ground. So the team doctor knew that I needed to go to the hospital for scans. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have gone to the hospital. I wouldn't, you know, it's the awareness of concussion in cycling is to a large degree lacking. But thankfully we had a doctor who was very aware and saw what was happening. So he, once I got back to the team bus out of the ambulance, we got in another ambulance and went to the hospital. And I was trying to come back to Nice as soon as I could, because I spent a night in Italy for observation at the hospital. But just where we were in Italy, I don't actually remember where it was, but it was like almost impossible to get back to Nice. There was no airport close. The race was leaving, so the team couldn't take me anywhere. There's no train. So actually Phil Deignan drove from Nice with my wife, who was here supposed to be watching me in Paris-Nice, but I was in Torino. He drove 14 hours to come pick me up and took me back to Nice the day after I had crashed.
And I mean, you said you had a concussion. Was it obvious to you? I think you had concussion before, but was it obvious to you how serious the injury was, and you know what it might mean?
No, not at all. I mean, this is like my sixth concussion. Like, three of those have been pretty severe. Like, you know, I've had kind of long-term side effects. None of those prior to this one I'd been properly, you know, diagnosed and also gone through like a recovery plan.
They've all been crashing bikes?
All cycling, yeah, all cycling. So after, you know, I came back to Nice, and you know, the team's like, hey, take 6 to 8 days off your bike, which in my mind at the time is like forever. You know, if in the middle of the season in March, taking 8 days off the bike is like eternity. You know, you know, Basque Country is a couple of weeks away, in the Ardennes, and you know, California. So my wife was here, and she was really, you know, adamant that I listen to the doctor's instructions and take time off. And all the while, I was seeing other specialists here in Nice and in Monaco, doing more CAT scans and MRIs and X-rays and whatnot. But I was really excited for my wife to leave and go back to the U.S. because then I didn't have supervision to train again. You know, because like my wife was like, "You can't ride." Like, you know, and once I leave, like, you can do a week only on the trainer for 30 minutes. And I was very adamant that, like, once she leaves, I'm by myself. I can get right back to it, because that's just your mindset as an athlete. You don't, the health of your body isn't as important as, you know, your objectives as for your career and for your season.
But how did you feel? I mean, did you feel physically you could do that? Was it just the medical advice that was holding you back? Or, you know, did you feel physically like there was nothing stopping you getting back on the bike?
No, I've definitely felt different. You know, it's also, I had crashed, so you're sore and you're, you know, I was definitely mentally and, you know, like spatially and, you know, balance and vision was not as it was, but I just assumed that would stuff that, you know, those were things that would return very quickly. So once my wife went back to the U.S., I actually did like jump on the trainer the day she jumped on the airplane. And after 20 minutes, like a pretty severe, you know, like flood of symptoms arose, you know, symptoms that I'd been having, but just more severe, like headaches and blurry vision and double vision. You know, I was fatigued. I slept a lot. I was like I just wasn't my normal self as far as energy level and, you know, just, yeah, general health, I guess.
That must have been quite scary, no?
At the time, it was more frustrating than scary. You know, like I said, at that moment in time, I was so focused on getting back to what I do. And also my entire existence in Nice is cycling. You know, so if I'm here and I'm not training or racing, and it's like, what am I doing here? You know, I live with other cyclists. All my friends are other cyclists. So I started to feel more isolated as I took more time off the bike, because I was like, I didn't really want to be around cycling that much because I couldn't participate. And it just made me feel like I was getting further behind when, you know, I saw my roommate get kitted up and head out the door every day to ride. And I was, you know, would maybe go for a 20 or 30 minute walk to the grocery store because I wasn't able to drive. And that was like my day.
I mean, in the previous concussions that you've had, have you ever had symptoms like that, or was this a more serious case?
You know, it's hard to look back and really, I mean, my worst concussion outside of this one was actually in 2012 before Tour de l'Avenir. It was the day before the race started, and Ben King and I were out test riding these time trial bikes that were from the national team, and I didn't have my helmet on because we were like a K from the hotel just making sure they fit. And I ran into the back of a car, hit my head on the pavement, and was unconscious for 5 minutes. And in that meantime, Ben had gone back to the hotel to get the director, and people on the street had called the ambulance. And at the same time the ambulance had arrived, our director had arrived, and he took me into the team car because he knew if I went to the ambulance, I wouldn't be able to start Tour Lavenir the next day. And I was 19 at the time, which making Tour Lavenir team as a 19-year-old was like, you know, a dream come true. It was something that I wasn't going to, you know, give away. I wasn't going to give away that opportunity. But because I didn't have my helmet on as well, I had like extreme swelling in my on the right side of my head. So much so that the next day for the race, I had to like get a razor blade and cut out my helmet to fit my helmet on straight so it actually fit on straight, because there's so much swelling I couldn't hear out of my ear for 2 weeks. And looking back at that race, like I had a tremendous amount of symptoms, but my desire to be part of that race and to help the team, because Finney won the prologue, Talansky had the, you know, a second overall. You just ignore the symptoms that are there, because it wasn't, and this was 2010, there was very little concussion awareness in general, but especially in the sport of cycling. Yeah, so it was stupid at the time, but you know, it's something as an athlete you kind of ignore a lot of symptoms in order to continue on.
Going back to you and what happened next, so you're in Nice, you're feeling frustrated, and I guess quite isolated here as well, not being able to train and ride your bike with no you know, kind of goal in sight, I suppose. What happened then?
So I was speaking with my team, Katusha Alpesin, at the time, and I kind of, with the team doctors and the management, it was decided that I was going to go back to the U.S. to get, you know, kind of more help, you know, as far as like physical or, you know, vestibular therapy and kind of physical therapy returning to play. And it just made more sense that I had help there. You know, my wife was there and her family, and I had more access. I spoke the language more fluently than I do French. So it was an easier place for me to kind of recover and get better. So I went back to the U.S. This must have been like the first week in April, so 3 weeks after my crash. And very quickly got connected with some doctors at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, which is kind of like the big medical center near us, and started to develop like a recovery plan as far as, you know, how can I return to play as quick as possible. And I would say in general the protocol for return to play in the U.S. is more progressive than what they have in Europe at the time, or at least from the specialist I saw. You know, the doctors I saw here were very much of the mindset like, you know, stay in your room, wear sunglasses, sleep, don't do anything. And in the U.S. it's like, no, it's if you, you know, have a knee surgery, you need to start rehab as soon as possible, or else you're going to lose those pathways. So I very quickly kind of started on a new recovery path and different therapies, and I saw progression, you know, small steps. And it's, I guess for me at the time, it was again just extremely frustrating, because I, you know, this was now, you know, 3 weeks, a month since the crash, and I hadn't ridden my bike more than, you know, the 20 minutes I did on my trainer in Nice a week after the crash. And so all these goals I had for my season started to disappear. You know, first it was Tour California was my first kind of big target of the year, and come mid-April it's like, well, that's a month away, you're not gonna be ready for that. And then the Tour de France and, you know, these kind of goals kept disappearing, and I was so focused on those, you know, objectives rather than focusing on my recovery. And I was getting so much kind of input from different people, whether it was friends or people on, you know, social media writing me, try this, do this, and it became almost to the point where I was overwhelmed with, you know, input of what I should be doing, that I kind of like had to take a step back. I was like, I can't do any of this because there's too much going on about what I should do. And, you know, it was a contract year as well, which, you know, doesn't help your stress level, which also doesn't help your recovery process.
Yeah, you were out of contract, obviously, at the end of the year. So, yeah, that must have been a pressure that you felt, and a lot of uncertainty around your team as well.
Yeah, and to be honest, I felt, you know, especially once it came into like July and August and I hadn't returned to racing, I felt a lot of guilt as far as what I was doing to the other riders on the team, because I know we are already shorthanded. You know, Marcel stopped in May. You know, we already had a small team to begin the season, and then I was out, and so I felt guilty, like, well, I know, you know, because I've been on the other end of the spectrum where you're having to fill in for a rider. And so I felt guilty that, you know, Marco Haller raced 100 days this year or something. You know, the ironic thing is he was out most of last year with an injury. But I started to feel a lot of guilt as far as like how my actions were affecting the team as a whole. And then all the situation with the team folding and Ryder trying to find new contracts and what was going to happen. And I guess I got to the point where that didn't really bother me what was going to happen to the team as much as, like, I would say maybe in like August, I really got to the place where it's like my recovery is far more important than what happens to the team. I mean, if this doesn't happen, racing again isn't going to happen either.
At this point, how were you feeling? You know, were you back on the bike, and did you feel that had those symptoms gone away?
So in mid July, I started training, you know, kind of substantially more. I was back into doing, you know, some like 15 to almost 20 hour weeks on the bike. Very like low intensity, just riding for the most part. And kind of with a goal of like, maybe I can try to make it back and do the Vuelta. And that was, you know, mentally I was like, I can get back and do that. And once I started incorporating intensity into the training, then a lot of those symptoms came back. And then it's like kind of like, you know, two step forward, one step back, because, you know, I kind of felt like, well, I'd done all this therapy and I'd been going to see doctors and specialists and, you know, spending a lot of money to recover. And I still wasn't there. And so that was frustrating. So I kind of lost motivation. And, you know, by the end of July, I realized like, I may not race the rest of the year. Which is scary knowing you're on a contract year.
Were you also learning a lot about concussion at this point? And what did you learn about it? And what did that, don't know, did that make you apprehensive about, you know, even whether you wanted to come back as well?
So I learned a lot about concussion. So kind of fast forward a little bit, in September I went down to UNC, the University of North Carolina, and did a whole new evaluation on my head and recovering there, like one of the leading kind of hospitals in the U.S. as far as sports concussion. And in hindsight, I wish I had gone there in April, because we had found out there that a lot of my symptoms were coming through my vision and the lack of my eyes, you know, acting as one kind of unison. You know, I had extremely bad double vision, which I just associated with like a headache, and I just wasn't feeling right. And the optometrist there is like, you have pretty severe double vision, which I've been able to slowly correct. It's not completely fine yet with, you know, wearing some special glasses when I'm reading or on my phone or computer, and then doing a lot of this ocular therapy to help my eyes track, you know, as they should and as they did before. So I've learned a lot about concussion, and it's something that definitely interests me to try and help other athletes, and especially cyclists in the future, because there's just not a network of, you know, really awareness out there at the moment. And yeah, so, you know, all the while I was still very eager to try and race again and to, you know, secure a contract for 2020 with a new team, because I, you know, I've been racing my bike since I was 12 years old. I didn't have any idea as far as what I would do if I wasn't racing a bike. You know, my wife and I, you know, kind of built our whole life around this. You know, we've lived in France. And we bought a house in the U.S. because I've been fortunate enough to race a bike for a living. And if you took that away, also, what is my identity if I'm not a professional bike rider? And so my agent actually was able to find me a contract for 2020, which was awesome. But it also wasn't really until I had the opportunity to race again that I had to really consider, do I even want to race again, or is it healthy to race again? And what, you know, kind of what I had to make a choice then. And I, you know, that's when it became clear of what I would do next.
What was the medical advice on that? Were you taking medical advice on it? And were there people cautioning you against coming back?
And I heard everything from, like, I wouldn't ride a bike again, to specialists, you know, I was hearing Nice especially, who are cycling fans, like, oh, you're like, we'll get you back soon, like, I want to see you in the Tour de France this summer. So I heard a wide range of opinion, which I think is part of the issue in, you know, head injury and head trauma, is that we don't really know that much. You know, if you break your collarbone, you go and you get it plated, and 10 days later you're riding again. You know, my former teammate and good friend Nathan Earl crashed and broke his femur in a race in Spain the same day that I had crashed, and he was racing, you know, 3 months later, which is like, breaking your femur is a big injury. You know, I didn't break any bones, I just hit my head. And still there's not you know, I've never received like a clear answer as far as like what are the consequences if you hit your head again. I mean, you could, you know, I could trip walking and hit my head and it could be, you know, life ending. You could also crash and hit your head again extremely hard and there could be no consequences. I mean, I guess what I've been told is every head injury is a bit like a fingerprint. They're unique and it depends on how you hit your head and your brain as a, you know, as a muscle. But I mean, the frequency of hitting your head definitely doesn't help. You know, it definitely, you know, is compounding the more frequent it is.
So when it came to the moment of, you know, weighing up whether to carry on, take this new contract, how did you make the decision, and how difficult a decision was it?
I guess in my head, I kind of knew what I should do, and I tried to, I don't want to say leverage, but I tried to get people to make the choice for me. You know, whether it was doctors, my wife, my parents, friends, and no one wanted to make that call for me. Which is like the right thing that everyone around me did, was it had to be my choice. And I think once I actually had an offer to race again, that was when actually I finally realized that actually I don't. And I can't go back to racing road bikes as a professional, which was a hard choice to make, but something that I don't have any regrets over. And I don't, you know, I've had a fantastic career. I guess to be able to walk away from professional road cycling on my own terms was something very unique as well. You know, there's a lot of riders who I've raced with who have left on unfortunate terms, and they are to a degree like cynical towards the sport. And I love cycling. I love road racing. I love watching road racing. You know, I have a lot of admiration for people who are still doing road racing because it's incredibly, you know, it takes an incredible amount of sacrifice, which I know what it's like, but I just wasn't willing to go back and make those sacrifices anymore.
Well, when we met here four years ago, and you talked about four and a half years ago, I guess, you talked about the presentation that you gave to Dave Brailsford at Team Sky when you were making the case for a new contract. You said you found that the other day in your apartment when you're going through all your stuff, and that the things that you said you wanted to achieve, you have actually achieved.
Yeah, which is pretty crazy. You know, looking, I kind of just found it on a whim going through my apartment, packing up and moving back to the U.S. And I can't remember all of them right now, but I know like one of them was to ride the Tour de France, which I did last year with Katusha. You know, getting a top five result in the World Tour stage race, which I did in Tour California. And there's some other, you know, metrics on there, or, you know, kind of goals that I had set. And that's pretty, I mean, personally, it's looking back on, you know, kind of my life and career as a whole. It's, I mean, I'm almost kind of in shock about, you know, when you're surrounded by all these, you know, phenomenal athletes, it's normal. Like, you know, I rode with Kwiatkowski the other day and he's just like a normal guy. But then to realize like this guy's won, he's the world champion on a bike. You know, when I was 12 years old, I never would have imagined that I'd be out, you know, riding as a friend with a world champion. And that becomes normal. So it's kind of having taken this step back and see what I've accomplished, which on a cycling podcast is not very much. You know, I never really won a race, you know, compared to other people who are in the sport. But I guess personally, I can look back and realize how, you know, amazing of a journey it's been and what I have been able to accomplish. You know, I, you know, got a race with, you know, Froome and Wiggins and Richie, like on the same team and room with these guys who, you know, were, you know, childhood heroes when I was, you know, 18, 19, 21. And to race with those guys and be teammates with them is actually, looking back on it, it's kind of, doesn't want to make me cry, but it's been awesome.
You feel at peace with the decision. I know you've been riding your bike a bit here and going out with guys like Kwiatkowski and Larry Warbass and people like that. Have there been, you know, moments where you've thought, maybe I could still do this?
Yeah, Larry went out the other day and was doing some like intervals, and I tagged along just to see if I could still do it and see what he was doing. And I've always been one to really enjoy like the physical side of cycling, like the physiology and the training and the process of getting fit. You know, and I watched a bit of the Vuelta this year, And there's times when you see a rider who's maybe was at a similar level to you, have a good result, and you're like, oh, maybe I could do that. But then I saw some of the crashes and just the carnage, and it just, yeah, it blows me away. And even just riding with those guys here, like through traffic and watching them on descents, it's, no, I won't miss that, because it really is crazy.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is supported by Alzheimer's Society.
850,000 people in the UK are living with dementia, and that number is predicted to rise to 1 million by 2025. Alzheimer's Society works to help people who are living with the disease by giving them and their families support while also working to find a cure.
Well, it's the start of a new year, Richard. It's a time when we all look ahead and set ourselves challenges for the months ahead. Alzheimer's Society has a series of charity cycling events for riders of all abilities that people can take part in 2020.
They do indeed. For beginners, there's a London to Brighton ride on September the 13th, with 4,000 riders taking on the 54-mile challenge, a challenge that we're familiar with, Lionel, having done a similar event last year. It finishes on Brighton Seafront. There are three night rider events in June and July in London, Liverpool and Bristol, which take you through the city at night.
Yeah, well, I've fond memories of the London to Brighton. Intermediate level riders might want to take on Ride London on August the 16th. This is pretty much as big as it gets in the UK. 30,000 riders tackling a 100-mile course on closed roads, finishing in front of Buckingham Palace. Or there's Velo Birmingham on June the 21st, also 100 miles long and on closed roads in the West Midlands.
And for the experienced riders, there's a multi-day challenge, the four-day London to Paris ride in July, or the nine-day Deloitte ride across Britain, one of the toughest events around. I know a few people who've done that, actually. It takes you from Land's End to John O'Groats.
So if you're looking for a brilliant cycling challenge this year, check out alzheimers.org.uk/cycle and help Alzheimer's Society to get closer to a cure for dementia.
That's alzheimers.org.uk/cycle. Yes, cycling is the protocols that exist in some sports are more easily managed because of the way the sports are set up. You know, you can leave the pitch for a few minutes, come back, and the players are all still there. They haven't moved 5 kilometres down the road to another stadium. How could a concussion protocol work in cycling?
So I sit on the board of the North American Riders Union, the ANARPC. So I've been trying to connect them with UNC to see if we could establish some type of baseline testing for at least starting with the North American riders, and you know, trying to push anything through the UCI is, you know, hitting your head against the wall. But trying to start something, get something in place. And how does that look once? How do you implement that within a race? And how do you implement team doctors or medical staff on the race from identifying a concussion is extremely difficult. I did see Specialized just came out with this is AGI. It's like a something in your helmet that is, I guess, identifies if you've hit your head. And so if you could somehow quantify what that load is and set like a baseline, if someone has this much force to the helmet, then they're going to be pulled out of the race. I think the issue is, I mean, that's part of the beauty of cycling is guys crash, break their bones, and finish the stage or finish a stage race. And that's part of the romantic side of cycling is, you know, someone crosses the finish line, you know, banged up and bloody. I mean, it's not as funny when it's a head injury, and oftentimes it's not seen. It's almost this invisible injury, and that's the same with trying to identify what, you know, to identify the injury to begin with. So how do you regulate that? It's not really an easy topic.
That's an interesting potential development, that a helmet could have some kind of alarm or you know, warning system. And I don't know if are you keen to work with helmet companies? Because I don't know if helmets could have some kind of way of offering more cushioning. I don't know if there's any kind of technology that could exist to just offer the head a little bit more protection.
Yeah, well, I was actually out at, you know, Oakley was one of the sponsors of Katusha, so I was actually out there in May talking to them about helmets and, you know, glasses obviously as well, but, you know, they were asking me, you know, what personally is more important? Is it, you know, the safety of the helmet, or is it the weight of the helmet, or the aerodynamics of a helmet? And I think it's more the culture of the sport. And I'd say most riders would say the weight or the aerodynamics over the safety. You know, my perspective has changed dramatically. I don't ride my bike, you know, a kilometer without a helmet on now, just because helmets are, you know, have come a long way and they can save your life. But I do think that, you know, whether helmet companies got together and designed some type of universal system to, you know, track, you know, kind of force to the head. But then again, it's not always, you might have a lot of force and you might, like I said, it's like a fingerprint. You might have no damage and your head might be fine. You know, you could have no force and just the way you whiplash your neck, you could have a severe concussion. And that's just kind of the unknown about, you know, head trauma.
And your health now, what are the sort of, are there any long-term effects from the six concussions that you've had, but the one in March in particular, or will those symptoms kind of disappear over time, or do you not know?
You know, so I'm doing a lot better now, and especially since, you know, so I had very regular headaches up until probably late September. And then once I went down to UNC and once I kind of got my vision sorted, that, like, I haven't had really any major headaches since then, because my eyes are operating better with my brain. I do still notice I'm not the person I was before the crash in March. You know, my spatial awareness is still off at times, especially in, like, under more fatigue. If I've been training a lot or traveling a lot and I'm more fatigued, I make more mistakes, you know, even whether it's memory or, you know, just, yeah, I'm not the same. Hopefully I can continue to improve. And I think that, you know, with the progression I've seen over the course of, you know, 8 months now, which for most injuries in cycling, 8 months is a very long time. But, you know, I've been part of another kind of meetup group of people who have experienced, you know, traumatic brain injuries. And for a lot of these people, 8 months is a very short window of time of recovery. So, again, it's the perspective that you have based off of, you know, kind of the context of the world you're coming from.
So now looking to the future, did you, when it started to dawn on you that, you know, you might have to stop racing, did you start looking for other opportunities out there? What were you thinking about how you would spend your time? What you would do in the future?
I panicked a lot at first, because I have put so much energy and time into my career for so long. Yeah, but then, and I guess while I was in that kind of limbo of should I race again or should I not, you know, I was kind of sitting on this fence, which is like the worst place to be because you can't really move forward in a career beyond cycling until you've made a choice to stop cycling. And the world of cycling is small. Once you kind of put word out that you might be looking for something else, well, then you've completely shot yourself in the foot as far as trying to return to racing if I wanted to, if I was able to. But I thought of everything. I mean, I was considering going back to school. I was considering, you know, going to work on a farm, doing construction, doing something completely away from cycling and just walking away completely and not being involved in it. Like I said, I really love cycling. I love the sport. You know, I've put, you know, I don't have a college or university degree, but I guess I feel, in a sense, I have a degree in cycling. You know, I've spent, you know, 15 years of my life, you know, studying the sport and being involved in the sport. And it's a level of education that most people don't have in the sport unless they've, you know, raced at this level for as long as I have.
So you do have a job starting in January. How did that come about? And tell us what it is.
Yeah, so I'm going to be taking a job with Wahoo Fitness, which is an American company, producing heart rate straps, kicker trainers, the Element head bolts and the Element Roam. Shameless plug. But no, I've actually been with Wahoo since 2014 when they first started sponsoring Team Sky. And yeah, it's a relationship that just developed very naturally when, you know, Wahoo being an American company coming to Team Sky, I was one of the few Americans on the team. I grew a pretty close connection with Chip Hawkins, the founder of the company. And, you know, he actually, this was the first year when I came to Katusha, Wahoo didn't come with me, but they came to Katusha at the same time I did. You know, so I'm their like longest running athlete that they've had. And they offered me a job. You know, I've been speaking to them. I organized a bike ride in Vermont in September, the Peach and Fall Fondo, and they've been the title sponsor of that for 2 years. So I have a close connection with them, and we've always been kind of going back and forth on different ideas, and I've done different, you know, blogs for them and some kind of like R&D whatnot. And they kind of have a gap in their portfolio right now as far as the liaison between the brand and the World Tour teams and the professional riders, and they saw it fit, and I was, you know, obviously in a point of transition that they were able to offer me a job going forward.
So you'll be there hanging around the buses at stage starts and so on, jostling with us.
Yeah, hopefully battling with Tim Karrison on how to use the trainers and whatnot.
How do you feel about that though, entering the world of real work? Not saying that cycling isn't real work, but it's going to be quite an adjustment, I imagine.
Yeah, most definitely. And my wife's just started like a full-time job as well. She's been kind of doing some freelance stuff for the last couple of years, and seeing her, you know, work an eight-hour day is very frightening to me. You know, part of my role with Wahoo is also going to be racing some of the gravel events in the U.S. and potentially in Europe. I say racing, also riding. I mean, depending on my ability and my health, participating in some gravel rides. Which is also really important for me because I do want to stay, you know, fit, and I love riding my bike. So that's extremely important as well. I don't, you know, I guess, you know, there was a long time this summer when I wasn't, or the season, I guess, when I wasn't really training and I didn't have another job and I became extremely bored. You know, there's only so much kind of physical therapy I could do in a day. And it became like very quickly apparent that I can't do nothing. Like I need something to be focused on and something to wake up to every day and kind of push me forward. I can't just sit around and hang out. And that was always one of the things I struggled with as a racer, was like rest days were the worst days of the week. You know, there's nothing to do. But it's definitely going to be a transition, and I know that. And, you know, I think the biggest thing that you lose when you stop racing is like the excuse that you're, you know, training, or, you know, you're tired, or, you know, you focus a lot on yourself. And I guess I kind of put it to myself, like, I've been extremely selfish for my career for a long time. But like, it's time I be a little bit selfish for myself and for my health and, you know, for my family and for my wife.
You sort of downplaying the gravel riding, but you will be doing some races. I mean, are the competitive fires still burning? Do you think that once you get into that, you might, you know, develop some ambitions in that as well?
Yeah, I think that's inevitable. I think, you know, even when I was following Larry around training the other day and he was doing his efforts, I was like, oh, maybe I should attack him just to see what I can do. Yeah, and you know, my goal is definitely to return to like a pretty high level of fitness and competition in those races. I don't want to be overly ambitious because my health is still my number one priority. And that's one thing that Wahoo's been very clear with, is, you know, they would love for me to be competitive, but, you know, I have a job with a company that is beyond just race. And so the pressure to perform isn't like it would be if I was trying to race on the road, where that's of the utmost importance. So if I can, if I'm able, if I, you know, get back in a more group setting and I feel fine, and I feel safe, and I feel like I can, you know, kind of manage the risk level, because it's still, you know, I'm still willing to take a certain level of risk, obviously, because I'm still riding a bike, which you can crash at any point. Yeah, I'd love to be competitive, and I never want to. Well, I guess I won. There was a team time trial we won in the Vuelta with Sky in 2016 or 17, but outside of that, I haven't won a race in a really long time. So it would be cool to win something.
I mean, it seems absurd to be asking you for a career highlight, because it seems to me like yesterday that I interviewed you and Danny Pate together at Team Sky camp in Mallorca in, I guess, 2013, would that have been? But what is your highlight? What's your standout memory from your career?
Ooh, standout memory. Like I said, that winning that team time trial at the Vuelta in, must have been 2016. That was a career highlight, for sure, as far as like a victory. I guess another highlight, I mean, I think also just doing the Tour de France last year. I mean, it wasn't a result, but you know, to have a dream when you're 12 years old of racing the Tour, and then to actually, like, you know, when the gun went off on stage one, to, you know, rolling through the finish line on the Champs-Élysées, that just the entire experience of that was a highlight.
A lot of riders, I think, retire if they've not ridden the Tour. It's like an itch that you can't get rid of. So I guess, you know, if I was to ask you the corollary of that, are there any regrets? Would you have liked to have won a race, or I guess you would have liked to have won a race, but is there anything that you feel is unfinished business, or are you quite content?
The one thing I did not do that I, you know, would have liked to is go to the Olympic Games, and that was a big consideration in stopping my road career, because it was something I feel like in the U.S. especially, the Olympics, being an Olympic athlete kind of transcends, you know, all sport. And yeah, but the reality is I'm content to not have gone to the Olympics, and, you know, who knows, maybe I'll pick up rowing in Wiggins and I can go row in London 2024 or something.
Well, that was Ian Boswell there. In the first part, he told us all about his crash in Torino and the effects that had on him, and how it was the sixth concussion of his career and life. And then we heard some of his thoughts about concussion protocol in cycling, and also what he's going to do next, which is to race on gravel in the US. But, I mean, some pretty horrifying detail in there about concussion, especially, I thought, the crash that he had the day before the Tour de l'Avenir in 2012 as a very young rider, where, you know, the swelling was so bad he had to cut the helmet to fit it on. But, I mean, this is a problem in cycling, isn't it? Partly, as we said in the interview there, because it's very difficult to, I guess, to analyse riders at the roadside as the race moves on, for doctors to perform a proper examination. And also because, as Ian said, it's an invisible injury. You don't always know how serious it is and what the kind of after effects are going to be.
It is a problem, Rich. It's a problem not just in cycling, but in other sports, as we become more and more aware of, particularly the one that's got a lot of attention, and rightly so, is NFL, American football. But also now, I think, as you touched on in the interview with Ian, in soccer, football, and this issue of, you know, heading the ball and whether that can cause permanent damage. I suppose another way of looking at it is that, you know, these risks have always been there, and in some ways they were greater before. All that's changed now is that we know about them and that we can detect them and possibly treat them. But it is, you know, when you talk about helmet technology in particular, and ways of sort of guarding against these dangers, you know, when I've read about the issue with relation to NFL in particular, one of the most alarming aspects of this problem is that, as far as helmets and protection are concerned, there's not an awful lot that can be done at this moment. And people have tried, you know, in NFL, you know, they've tried with different types of helmet technology, harder shells or different kind of shells, and also devices which provide feedback, which give information about how hard the hit is. And there are some sort of causes for encouragement there, but certainly nothing that's going to be a real panacea and completely solve the issue.
I think the thing that stood out for me was Ian admitting that he was waiting for his wife to go out the door and head back to the US so that he could get on his indoor trainer and carry on training as soon as possible, even though the doctor's advice was to stay off the bike a bit longer. And, you know, that probably shouldn't surprise me. And I mean, you know, Ian is an extremely bright man, and yet, you know, his priority was getting back on the bike and training rather than his, you know, medium and long term you know, health when it comes to the longer term effects of repeated concussions. And I think that's probably the area where the sport needs to protect the riders from their own from themselves, from their own drive, and I mean that's almost the impossible aspect of this, especially when, as you say, Richard, the symptoms can be quite delayed. It can, you know, sometimes isn't necessarily immediately obvious, and as you say, Rich, when somebody hits the ground in a race, their priority is to get back on the bike as quickly as possible and rejoin the peloton. It's not to stand by the side of the road and go through a 5-minute concussion protocol, because by the time that examination has been completed and the rider's given the green light to rejoin the race has gone. And so cycling got a real challenge there, especially as Daniel says, that, you know, the science and the knowledge of the longer term consequences of hard hits to the head become more apparent. So it was quite a jarring interview to listen to, really, just because the demands of the sport contradict so completely the longer term health of the athletes.
And I think, Rich, you know, just more broadly on Ian and, you know, that moment in Tirreno where everything sort of changed for him. And, you know, I remember watching it on TV and it looked not a sort of benign crash, but it looked a fairly routine crash. I mean, like we see in most races, he was sort of lying on the tarmac and it was pretty obvious that he wasn't going to get up and rejoin the peloton. But beyond that, it was difficult. You would never have suspected that it would have the consequences that it's had. But, you know, he's obviously, you know, he's got to reinvent himself now. And I think he's someone who is certainly bright enough to do that. And he sounds as though he's ready for that. But in a way, it got me thinking, and he also touched on it in the interview, of how, you know, for a lot of riders, they've already had to go through that sort of process of kind of shedding a skin and shedding a sort of that outer layer of their identity during the course of their pro careers, because, you know, a lot of them have been incredibly successful as juniors and amateurs and have been the best in their age group and in some cases, you know, among the best in the world. And then they have to sort of reinvent themselves as guys who are not going to win a lot and who are going to be content with sort of, you know, almost clocking in every day and doing their job. And that's really, you know, that's kind of what happened to Ian. And he ended up having a very good career in that role. But, you know, we often think that, we often see it in binary terms. They're either bike riders, pro athletes, or not. But, you know, there is a process of evolution that a lot of them are going through during their career, where they're already kind of maturing and starting to think about life sort of beyond the peloton.
And I think when, you know, when riders are missing in action, as it were, like, as Ian was for so much of last year, you're kind of, a lot of people are asking, well, where's Ian Boswell? You know, he crashed in Tirreno, but why is he not racing? And what, you know, and to get an insight from him into what that's like to be on the sidelines, to not be racing, the guilt of that as well, especially when your team isn't performing as his team wasn't. You know, he talked about Marco Haller really shouldering a big old burden of racing and feeling guilt about that. And I found that fascinating too, the idea of Nice being like a prison for him almost, because Nice meant one thing, and it meant riding his bike and training. And without that, he was sort of trapped there and miserable. And I, you know, thought his insight and his way of articulating how that felt was fascinating.
We've talked about this topic, haven't we, of this heightened consciousness that we all encounter to a certain extent, also that comes through social media. And, you know, we talked about this idea of Strava Noia last year, but, you know, that, what you just described, Rich, that sort of guilt or that sort of sensitivity to what everyone else is doing is heightened by, you know, our greater awareness of what our peer group is doing and what, you know, a rider's peer group is doing. And that must have been difficult as well.
Just lastly on Richard, I was listening to you while you were talking to Ian in that interview, kind of thrashing around for whether or not there's a big scientific leap forward in helmet technology, whether there could be almost some kind of indicator of how hard the helmet has taken a hit to, you know, I don't know, maybe sort of some kind of traffic light system, so that a first case you could say, well, look, I'm sorry, mate, the helmet's taken a red hit, you're out of the race. An amber hit, you know, would
although be, as he said, the severity of the hit isn't necessarily,
well, that's the point. So it's a really difficult one, and it's kind of, you know, we would never obviously go back to the days when the riders raced without helmets, because in a funny way, has the style of racing evolved in such a way that the peloton as a collective kind of feels like they can take greater risks because they have the protection on their heads. I mean, would a rider in the 70s have backed off from certain situations? You only have to look at the photographs and talk. Certainly, it's anecdotal. It's not a scientific study, but the riders race faster and much closer together than they did in the 70s and 80s, for example.
I think that's definitely true, Napalm. Again, it's not scientific. This is not going to sort of lead us anywhere. No one's suggesting that we go back to those days. But you only have to look at sprint finishes from even the 90s, and you look at the overhead shots, the helicopter shots, and you compare the sort of distances between the wheels. And, I think there was a sort of a sixth sense, a danger instinct that the riders had that was more sharpened and heightened than it is now, partly because of helmets, partly because of better braking now, and possibly higher stakes. But
Well, we should leave it there. Thanks to Ian for sharing his story with us, because it's something he got in touch with us even as early as sort of during last year's tour and said he would do, and it was all about timing for him. Mm. And he's obviously announced that he's moving into a new role and a new life. So good luck to him, and really looking forward to having him involved with the podcast as well. Before we go, Daniel, you wanted to say a little bit about Bjarne Riis. We mentioned this last...
You make it sound like I'm about to launch into a fabulous monologue, Richard. That's going to...
That's what I thought you were going to do.
The definitive answer and soliloquy on whether Bjarne Riis... Still has a place in lukewarm cycling.
Well, we mentioned it in last week's podcast in passing, didn't we, that Bjarne Riis was being appointed as we recorded as the new performance director, is that what it's called, at Team NTT, which is formerly Dimension Data. And that was obviously confirmed, and he is in situ. Is he the man to turn that team's fortunes around?
Well, I think he probably is, Rich, but... The issue that most people have is not to do with his credentials as a team manager. I mean, they're obviously pretty good and pretty successful if you look what he achieved at CSC in particular, and then Saxo Bank thereafter. The issue that most people have is more of an ethical one. Obviously, Bjarne Riis is well known, doped quite extensively during his career as a rider, won the Tour de France in 1996. There was a lot of evidence in the years thereafter that he had doped, but it took him a long time to finally come clean, and he came clean really when he had no option. His back was very much against the wall. So, that already didn't sit well with a lot of people. And then as a team manager, there were various riders in his teams who were exposed to dope cheats, probably most famously, infamously, Ivan Basso at the 2006 or just before the 2006 Tour de France, and Riis sent him home. And we've never really had been able to establish definitively how much Riis knew about Basso's doping, how much he knew about other riders doping on his team. As I say, Basso wasn't the only one. People will have very much mixed feelings about this. And also because there was a sort of a bit of a flirtation between a precursor or the previous incarnation of NTT, as they will be called, and Bjarne Riis about 4 years ago, when Brian Smith was still involved as... I can't remember whether Brian was a team principal or general manager, but there were rumours back then that Riis might come on board as a team manager, and the team put out a statement sort of in response to those rumours at the time, saying that he wasn't someone who was consistent with the ethics of the team. Obviously, a thinly veiled allusion to what we've just been talking about.
And I guess, that team moves further away, both geographically and, if you like, sort of, ethically from what it started out as, which was an African team. with a real African identity to it, and with a mission above and beyond winning bike races. And when, you know, this, I guess, you know, having Rhys involved and having his, the company that is involved with Virtue Cycling as a part owner of the team now, just, it just takes the team a little bit further away from that, that founding ethos, I suppose. They have been drifting away from that over the years as other sponsors have come in and so on, but it doesn't really feel like the same, the team that were the sort of underdogs a few years ago when they were MTN Quebec, and if you remember, Steve Cummings won a stage and they really made a splash in their first Tour de France.
I think my point would be, I mean, Bjarne Riis has been out of the sport quite a long time now. It's not a progressive move on any front, really, is it? It's a kind of a desperation move for a team that has been pretty beleaguered in terms of the lack of race wins they've had over really quite a, what is becoming quite a long period of time. I mean, you know, we don't necessarily base everything on the UCI rankings, but if you just had to draw up a kind of league table of how the World Tour has looked, I mean, Dimension Data have been bumping around in the non-existent relegation zone for a couple of seasons now. So it doesn't look like a sort of progressive move, really, to bring Bjarne Riis in. And well, you know, but I'm not running the team. But if I was running a team, he wouldn't be particularly high on my list of people to bring in. Not least because I don't think that, you know, he's quite dour, isn't he? He's quite prickly when dealing with the media. You know, he's not going to put a smile on people's faces, is he? I wouldn't have thought. It doesn't.
No,
does that matter? Does that matter?
We can't all be Lionel Burney.
I can see some similarities.
But, you know,
money talks, doesn't it, chaps? And, you know, there's no doubt that the part of the reason why Riis has been brought in is either some money in sponsorship or the promise of money in sponsorship through his Virtue organisation. But, you know, you say he's dour, Lionel, and, you know, that I think that's possibly true from our point of view, but I do think, as I hinted at last week, I do think that he's someone who can really motivate people. You only have to, you know, if you talk to any of the members of the sort of telecom team in the mid-90s and you talk about the effect that he had on the team, just his presence. And he's someone that, you know, people tend to sort of balk at this nowadays, but the sort of motivational effect of fear. But he is someone who has a very intimidating aura, which can, I think, in a lot of cases, act as a bit of a motivational fuel, whether that's sort of vis-a-vis the riders or, you know, the staff at Dimension Data. You know,
he utilises silence very well, doesn't he?
He does. And I think that probably remains intact, even with a younger generation of riders who won't be, you know, a lot of them won't even be aware of his achievements as a rider, or sort of disgraced achievements, as some of them are now as a rider. I think that regardless of that, he will still be able to exert a certain influence.
Will they be going on team bonding, you know, paintballing, whitewater rafting, 10-pin bowling? I'm getting more absurd with my team bonding exercises, but he was kind of famous for that, wasn't he? The CSC used to go off for a winter training camp in the wilds, all donning khaki fatigues.
They had the sort of SAS. He'd become a bit of a he'd become a big celebrity in Denmark, hadn't he? B.S. Christensen. And people were fairly unkind about what the BS might stand for. But he was sort of the, I don't know, what would be the equivalent on British TV? Is there a sort of Ray Mears kind
Bear,
of
Bear
with,
Bear
a, with a twist of a twist sort, more sort of military leaning?
Paintballing with NTT as a friend special, maybe.
The Cycling Podcast. For the latest news, views and interviews from the world of professional cycling. Support our work and get exclusive episodes by becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe.
Before we go, we should say big thanks to friends of the podcast. Lots of you have signed up. There are, I think, 4 episodes there at the moment. If you sign up on our great new system, which is very easy to hook up to, thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe. And if you pay a bit more than the £15, which is the standard amount for access to the French specials, you'll get a free, not free because you're paying for it, a signed copy of our book, The Grand Tour Diaries. And lots of you have been signing up for that, and it should be landing with a thud on your doormats if it hasn't already. So, from me, a big thanks to Vicky Chorman, Brian Croteau, Giles Hanglin, Steve Gert, Steve Pig, Patrick Jelfs, Dan Quigley, John Anglesey, Philip Whitaker, and Christopher Newmark.
And a big thank you to Matthew Smart, Nigel Clark, Matt Slotnick, Ben Lowe, Daniel Ruff, Paul Silversides, John Bailey, David Derbyshire, Tim Scott Ellis, and Joel Filial.
And from me to Peter King, Gary Hill, Ewan McCulloch, David Birch, Peter Stewart, James Allen, Edward Broom, Terence Gale, Mark Wan, and Barney Davison.
Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.